that's the reason I struggle with doing I pray that the Lord would give me an understanding of this, because when I get a lot of information, and some of you are the same way, not all of you, but some of you are the same way, a lot of information, instead of being able to put it together, it just kind of goes flying to the wind, and it's hard to grab a hold of, and you just kind of just studying this a line at a line. What the Lord gave me between 5 and 6 this morning was a better way to actually to have studied this. And this is the way I would have studied it. And so we're going to kind of talk that way. I would have studied chapter 8 and 10 together, because they go straight through. If you ever study Hebrews, you know there's a lot of parenthetical warnings or parentheses in there, which is like, he goes through the lens and says, stop, let me show you this. And then goes on and then goes, stop, let me show you. Well, this is kind of what the story of Mephibosheth is. And the story of Bathsheba are both, stop. Now let me tell you something about his character. I saw the picture of Mephibosheth and Bathsheba as contrasts. Because what do we know about, and this is all review, what do we know about David's response to Mephibosheth? What did he have the right to do?
He could have killed him.
He had the right to kill him as a king, as the previous king's last legitimate heir. What did he do instead?
He took him in.
Pardon?
He took him in like a son.
He did. So we see compassion, an enormous amount of compassion, wisdom, care, love towards Mephibosheth. And then you get the contrast. And you have the contrast with his relationship with Uriah. And I'm going to say Uriah because it's really Uriah that is the contrast. He had compassion towards Mephibosheth, but what was his attitude? What was his choices towards Uriah?
He sinned against him.
He sinned against him? Did he give him any credence at all?
He didn't even think of him. Of himself.
Yeah. Right there, right then, what was going on in his life?
He even sent him with a letter for his own execution.
Yeah. It's just kind of phenomenal. And the more we talk about Uriah, we will understand not only what an honorable man he was, but what a powerful position he was in. And how dare David do what he did all the way around. So, here is this man whose life we have seen as exemplary up to this point. And if you saw us, see, I read this. This is not my idea. I read this in, I think it was J. Vernon McGee, who said, if you look at a sea of white and you see one little teeny weeny black dot out there, what you see is not the sea of white, but the black dot. And when people think of David, what they think of is the black dot. And so we do have to remember it in the big picture, which is why I would have put Mephibosheth and the story of Uriah and Bathsheba together and seen the contrast. In all of us, we are capable of the worst kind of evil. Mm-hmm. And even the most evil person is capable of kindness.
Yes.
So we can't just write somebody off by situations in their life in one spot. We have to see their life. And so as we look at David and weep and grieve, and I did, I cried this week. It just makes me so sad of this man who has such an exemplary example to his people. Get the discussion that God gave him at the end of chapter, I think it's 12, 11, 12, I think it's 12. It's 12. Makes me sad. But then I think of each one of us, and not only would we personally pray that people would forgive us as God forgave David, but we need to have that same attitude towards others who are believers who have failed. If there is a continuous... Could you turn off that red... Is the red light on the bottom or the top? If it's on the bottom, leave it.
It's
looks like...
Bottom.
Okay, leave it alone. It just looks like it was on the top, and there's nothing in there. You've had them quite interestingly coated with black mud burnt before.
Yeah.
So I think as we dig into this lesson, we need to think about that. We need to think about how do we perceive others' sins as well as ours? And could we be Nathan? And we should all be able to be Nathan. That you've got to know that that was tough. One of the things you've got to know is he could have been annihilated right there. Joab knew probably as much as Nathan did. And you see a different response. Of course, Nathan was a prophet and a priest, so he had a bold tongue to start out with. But anyway, let's open a prayer. Father God, you have given us a lot of information in this class this week, and I pray that you help us grab a hold of it, not just for the sake of knowledge, but for the sake of understanding how big you were and how involved you were with Israel and how involved you were with David and how you loved him. And love chastises in times that it is needed, and love forgives but doesn't eliminate consequences. Lord, help us be that kind of person to understand the difference, to be able to love in truth and to understand what truth is. Thank you, Lord, for your mercy towards each and every one of us in this room, your compassion in our difficulties, your compassion in our dealing with our flesh. God, give us the strength to face those things and give them to you, that we might walk honorably, that we might walk with grace and truth towards others. In the name of your Son. Amen. Okay, I put on the board as our review just because we're going to start running into some of these people again. But I called, and we talked about it last week, and I don't remember what I named it last week, but I called chapter 8 the consolidating and expanding of Israel. Because that's what David was doing. He was consolidating and expanding. In fact, by the time you get done with chapter 8, he has bulldozed through and won, beat over southeast, southwest, and he finishes getting the north under his hand. All that's left is the west, and on the west we have the Mediterranean. So he pretty much gets what should have been Judah under his control. And so we see he defeats Saul was having his major problem with the Philistines. And so we see him in 8:3 defeat the Philistines. When I say defeat, it isn't annihilate, because they're still there. It's a different form, and we'll talk about that a little bit. He defeats Moab in 8:2. He defeats Hadad-Ezer, I'm not sure how you say that, of Zobah in 3 through 8, and we meet him again in 10. The Arameans of Damascus, which, by the way, is present-day Syria. When you see the Arameans, they are also known as the Syrians today, so you can kind of picture where they're at. In 8, 5, and 13, they all became his servants, and actually, the word can even be used slaves, but if you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, you find out that their version of the concept of slaves and ours is different. When they conquered a country, they were slaves for 6 years. But after that, they had their freedom. And this is sort of the way it's functioning here. So they were servants, but they paid tribute, and they did it on different levels. Pretty sure that's how you say that. Of Hamath blessed David because David beat his enemy, which was headed up there, and therefore they made a peace together, those two, Toy and David, or Israel. And then they hear more again from Aram and Moab in 8:12. And I don't have Edom down there, but Edom too. He built garrisons in Edom, which is sort of like a fort outpost kind of thing, in 8:14, and he did it in several other places too. And the chapter finishes really well. In fact, it's beautifully. It says the Lord helped David accomplish what he did. And David's response was both to reign and administer justice and righteousness. So we leave it in chapter 8 with a very beautiful picture all the way around. We see God's involvement. We see David's response to God's involvement. We see a man who can't fail because he's trusting the Lord. Okay? So as you think about that, think about it in relationship to ourselves. We look at this. We think of great leaders today, not too many, and great Christian people, and it's been really hard in my life to see people I respected, or I thought I respected, or I thought I knew who they were, fall, and we see Christian leaders fall, and they fall big when they fall. There was a pastor that, when I was a young Christian, my group, which was in Hollywood, worked with, and he was down in Newport, and he had written amazing books. He was an evangelist and well-known all over the country, and just a good man. And he fell about 15 years ago, but he wanted to repent. And so another pastor, I'm trying to think who it was, it may have been Ray Steadman at the time, took him in to walk with him through his healing process. He never went back to pastoring, but he is still very involved in ministering, because you can't put a person back in leadership, because it's leadership often that causes the crush. And that's why it's so important you pray for your leaders, for a lot of different reasons. The crush is in different ways. It can be depression. It can be adultery. It can be, I know one of the things Pastor Ken and I decided a long time ago was that I would have to okay women he counseled, and mostly he doesn't. But if he does, he often leaves the door open. There's just other things. And now he's getting old enough that he's more much worried about it, but what people say, but they might. There's just different processes, and so we all need to pay attention to that. We all need to be aware of it. Nobody is God himself, and nobody is Christ. And sometimes the pressure of being the expected perfect one is just too much for a man to take or bear. And I would think it would be harder even for a woman, to tell you the truth. And there are women out there that are pastors. But I just think it would be very, very hard on the emotions. So, anything anybody wants to add to that? All right. So, chapter 10. Let's look at chapter 10. Chapter 10 is also done with... Oh, my zero left. I wonder if it did on yours, too. Chronicles 19. What two countries do we talk about in this chapter that are sort of at war, or that Israel has war with?
The
Arameans. We're back to them again. But is it really with them, or is it somebody else primarily?
Well, the Ammonites that Susan, she said the Ammonites also.
So the Ammonites actually started.
Right.
It's the Ammonites. And what did the Ammonites do in relationship to the others?
They asked them for help.
They asked them for help. In fact, it was paid help. They were mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a mercenary, it's sort of like a shepherd. If they're your sheep, you have a tendency of doing what when the wolf comes?
Protecting.
Doing whatever it takes to deal with that wolf and protecting the sheep. If you have a pack of wolves come, it's not your sheep, what can happen easily?
Run.
Because your skin's on the line, and you're not willing to put your skin out for someone else's sheep. This is kind of what happened here, but let's look at this. Now it happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hunan, his son, or Hanun, his son, became king in his place. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. Now, who are these guys? Have we seen them before? Do we have any verses on them?
Yes, back in 1 Samuel.
Tell us about it.
1 Samuel 11:1.
Which says what? She's getting there.
Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, I will make it with you on this, do you want me to read the whole
yeah.
thing? Make it with you on this one condition, because this isn't pleasant. I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you, and I will make it a reproach on all Israel.
So this doesn't sound like somebody who's shown kindness, does it? But who is the leader at that time in chapter 11?
Saul.
Saul is.
Yeah.
So pay attention, because even though David wasn't Saul's enemy, Saul was David's enemy. And so what may look to Saul as something evil may not look that way to David. Just think about it. Okay, keep going.
Let's see. The elders of Jabesh said to him, let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, what is the matter with the people that they weep? So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces, and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. He numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. They said to the messengers who had come, thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow by the time when the sun is hot, you will have deliverance. So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Then the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you. The next morning Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp, and in the morning watch, and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. Then the people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men, that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. Then Samuel said to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly.
So the first time we see them, Saul is not the king. And it's out of this battle with the anointing of the Lord that he does become the king. So why do we have any idea why David would consider him having been compassionate or kind to him? We really don't. So we just have to trust he was. I mean, there's a lot of history you have to understand is not there, except for in little pictures, like remember when it said he renewed himself by the river? Well, it doesn't tell you what the river is there. You have to go to Chronicles to figure out it's the Euphrates. So with this, we just know that somewhere that relationship changed. Okay, yeah.
But we do see the river in regard to that. Throughout Scripture, when it's capitalized, it refers to the Euphrates.
To the Euphrates, right. So you have to go looking somewhere else, right?
Shows the connection that the men of Jabesh Gilead went and took down the bodies of Jonathan and Saul. mm-hmm. out of reverence for what Saul had done for them.
Right. So there, we see the little pieces, but we don't get it in the chapters that we're studying, so we forget how it all fits together. And I think sometime what might be helpful, and I understand three-quarters of you are not even interested in doing that, and that's fine. But start a little, like a spiral notebook, and put one country on each page, and then just kind of add when you learn something more about them, because we're not done with them yet. And we're going to go into even up to Amos and stuff, talking about some of these things. So just pay attention, then you'll go, why did they do that there? Why did they say that? And we don't know because we can't remember all these things. And we're not, what the Jewish people did is they repeated it year after year after year after year. So eventually it got more into their system. We tend to know the New Testament better for the same reason. We've gone over that more. So, I mean, even in Acts, we know more the systems of how Acts went together because we've heard them more than once. So, as we think about this, we have his son, and what did his son do? What did Nahash's son do?
Have we come to the messengers yet?
We're still in the first verse. Oh, okay. Well, actually, go ahead, because it's in that section. Tell us about the messengers.
Well, David sent messengers to give his sympathies, his empathy to the young ruler.
And why didn't David go?
I don't know.
Well, I think it's different than today. Today we would probably, if it was like a big nation, we'd have the crowned prince of the president go kind of thing. But because there are all sorts of... What is David doing anyway?
He's fighting.
He's, you know, their idea of a king is not the idea of a king that I ever had before. It really is sort of the ultimate warrior. Mm-hmm. And so he would be protecting his response. Part of his responsibility is not as much organizational as protective. So he is. If he leaves, what have we known with other nations that we've seen in the Old Testament? When somebody leaves, what happens to the country?
It goes back to where it was.
When the men leave to go on war, sometimes another country can come around and just take over the whole thing, including wives and children. So it isn't a smart thing to do that, but he sent people who were quite high in the, I'm going to call it government, I don't know that they would have called it a government, but people who were there on his behalf. What did, so he just received them and it was great, right?
No.
What happened?
He disgraced them. The young king disgraced
them. Why?
Because his advisors advised him that David had ill intentions and wasn't being pure in his,
Did they have any proof of that?
No.
They didn't have any proof of that. He took a counselor who told him to watch out. David's really looking to go through the city and figure out what's going on. Well, take that same concept to us. Does that ever happen to us? Do we ever hear what someone else says and we move on that and find out it wasn't true?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So jump to conclusions.
Come to conclusions. So what should we do when someone counsels us? Search out the scripture, check the facts, because it could have come from four different people by the time it got to them. And you know how that goes. It can change all the time. So he, for you to have heard something like that and be ready to take on a war, what does that tell you about your character?
Maybe not trustworthy.
Not trustworthy, fearful. Maybe I am afraid I'm not going to be the greatest king in the world, and Dad was, everybody liked him, and, you know, I have to stand here and prove my position in this situation. So, in a sense, his father had counseled him by the very fact he was David's friend. These guys come along and give him a different counsel, and he listens to them. So there's just something to think about when we are in places where we're listening to counsel.
Well,
go ahead.
And he doesn't just lock them up until he finds out the truth or until he talks to them further or whatever. I mean, he's obviously thinking, okay, well, I'm going to show off and we'll do this to them.
And he humiliates them.
And he's got to know it's going to get back to David because he sends them away. So, yeah. It just wasn't wise.
It was not wise. In fact, to David he became what? The act was what?
It was the enemy.
It said it was odious.
Mm-hmm.
What does odious even mean?
Stinks.
Yeah, Mary, King James says he stinketh.
Yes.
He stank. They stank. But what is, I mean, that would mean something to us. What did it mean to them? Because what was their response?
They were very humiliated.
They were humiliated.
Shame.
But what was the response of the Ammonites?
They went out and tried to hire some people to help them because they knew they were in big trouble.
Because to be odious to another person is, and it isn't always look the same, but the odious picture is one that sets it up for a war. If you are odious to me, it's more than just you didn't wear your deodorant this morning. It's that you have set yourself against me and we are now enemies. And you're way back there. How could I tell? By the way, does it smell better back there today? Okay. All right. So the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David. The sons of Ammon, they always say the sons of Ammon. Don't you think that's interesting? I had two places I looked up and found that word. Somebody want to look up Genesis 34:30? Genesis 34:30 and Exodus 5:21. Moses was preaching odious. Response was, you know, it's just interesting. Somebody want to read Genesis 34:30?
Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household."
So who made him odious?
Simeon and Levi.
The two sons. And what did they do? Well, you don't have to know. But they sinned, basically. And their sin made their father and his position in that situation odious. It would just, it would be as if, let's say, makeup story here. This is a makeup story. Your daughter with seven children, if one of the children did something that was horrendously immoral in the community, mm-hmm. that would reflect on the whole family and make them odious mm-hmm. to the community, if the community cared. Sometimes mm-hmm. they don't care. Moses in Exodus 5:21. Can't tell if it's 15:20 or 5:21 because preaching comes down in the middle of it. What does 5:21 say?
They said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand and kill us."
So these are the slaves in Israel. Moses has come in and he's speaking for God, and he said things that Pharaoh's not going to like. So the people who he was standing on behalf of, what was their response? Why the heck did you do this? So the odiousness carries with it more than just a personal thing. It's a responsive thing to a community. So when they knew that in the eyes of David they had become odious, they knew there was going to be problems. And that's in verse 6, and the first response is they hired the Arameans of Beth Rohab and of Zobah. Where does the name Zobah come up? Where have we seen that before? They put it right here.
Yeah.
20,000 foot soldiers and the king of Makkah with 1,000 men and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army, the mighty men. Now, is that the same thing or is that different things? The army and the mighty men. Might as well bring it up here. Chapter 23. Remember looking at chapter 23? Could you figure out what she wanted you to do there? I would suggest we all turn to 23 for a minute. See if I can find it. Samuel 23, yes.
First Samuel or
second? Second. We haven't even come to it yet in the thing, but it's been explained. It's been explained Bathsheba's situation and also this, and I can't find it. And I can't find my Bible. I'm not smart.
Page 181.
Oh, I do have that. but you don't have the whole thing.
No.
Well, somebody who has it, look at it, and what do you see listed there in chapter 23?
The names of his mighty men.
Of his mighty men. Mm-hmm. Read the first line. What does it say?
These are the names of the mighty men whom David had.
You don't have to worry about the names. Name one. Okay. Just say name one.
And
what does it say about him?
Chief of the captains.
Okay, now pay attention to this. There are 37 mighty men. Mm-hmm. There is a chief of the captain, which means he's kind of like the high boss. Ooh, thank you.
At one time.
Hmm?
He killed 800. Men at
killed
time.
800 men at one time. Let's see, what am I doing?
It was also called by another name.
Is that
what
it is?
Abino?
The Ace Knight? It's funny how, did you pick up in this song that was called by a different name too?
Yes.
I never knew
what
that
before.
What
was with that? I didn't either. That was
weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Check it down.
Okay, chapter 20.
Isn't there another
probably could have gotten my Bible, my phone out. I do have a Bible in that, too. Okay, that's what I said on Sundays. All right, let me see. Where are we? What verse?
Eight.
Okay, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. And there's the name of one of the chief or captains. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Aholite. I want you to pay attention in this list how many of them are not of the 12 tribes of Israel. Because what do we always think Israel and Judah means? They're all history Jews. They are not. One of the three mighty men with whom David, when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there to battle the men of Israel. So there's a second one. So there's so far two mighty men. Two of the three of the mighty men. So there's 37 mighty men. Then there's three that stand out, and they're called chiefs. And they're called captains, and they're over a certain amount of the other mighty men who are over the hordes, is all I can say. So, let's see. It doesn't have the third one here, but he's there. If you go on your cross references.
Verse 11.
When David rose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to me, the prophet Gad, David's seer, says, go to speak to David. I'm in the wrong chapter.
Oh, I'm sorry. 23, verse 11. Are you looking for the other mighty man?
After him was Shema. That's right. He's the third one. The son of Agi, the Hararite. And if you look up these different names, which is part of the reason I sent you some of that stuff, these are not Israelites. They become Israelites. They fight for Israel. I mean, you get it when you get the story of Uriah. And the Philistines were gathered to a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from it. Okay, look at 13. Then three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time. Okay, there you are. And then go over to 20. The Benahi, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of the Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the two sons of Ariel and Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. And he killed an Egyptian. Okay, I'm just going to look at their names. So you have Abishai, verse 18. He was the brother of Joab. He was one of the 30, but not one of the three. And then this guy, Benna, whatever, he was, again, one of the 30, but not one of the three. They keep saying this. Fact 23 says he was honored among the 30, but he did not attain to the three. So the three are very specific. And David appointed him over his guard. So they have all these different positions, but look at all these countries that they're part of. These are people in the past that have been enemies. And look down at verse 37. One of the 30 was Zelek, and he was an Ammonite. Where do you suppose he became part of Israel? Possibly the first battle with the Ammonites. 37, 23. And then it has Joab, the son of... So you see a lot of these names over again. Okay, look at verse 39. What does 39 say? That was part of your homework. Uriah the Hittite. So what was Uriah? He was a Hittite. Remember that when we hear what he has to say on why he doesn't go to his wife. It's beautiful. But again, you're not going to get all this in one shot, and certainly not in the chapters we're looking at. But as you look at that, you realize that there are 37 men who are high on the scale of being warriors, the mighty men. And when he talks about the 30 mighty men, this is who he's talking about. The three are above them, and each one of them have people under them. So, me, just naive that I was reading about Uriah, I always just think of Uriah as in the war. Uriah was not in the war. He was one of the commanders. Yeah.
In verse 18 of chapter 23, it says, Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief of the 30 also. So
right.
He was a chief.
He wasn't one of the three, though.
Yeah.
And the reason that's important, because we have him in a battle in a little bit, don't we?
So where does Joab fit into this? Is he head over the
whole
thing?
He's the chief of the chiefs, I think. The best I could figure out, because they always come to him. So they don't give him a title. He is he's the one who comes to David and gets David's direction.
So he's head over the whole kit and caboodle?
Yeah.
I can't tell you the verse, but it also does, when it talks about David organizing,
right.
He has his army, but he also has two
I can give
groups
you the verse.
Of guards.
I can give you the verse. It's the end of chapter 8.
That's
where it says it. And he does. He goes the list of what each one of them is responsible for, including his own sons who were
officers.
Who were officers, too. So it's very well organized. So when we see, as we come up to, all right, so we have the Ammonites who've gone off to the Arameans, which we know is present day what? Arameans?
Syria.
Present day Syria. And then said, when David, verse 7, said, heard of it, he said, Joab and all the army and the mighty men. The sons of Ammon came out and drew up the battle array in the entrance of the city, and while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Micah were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw the battle was set against him in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans. So he took one part. But the remainder of the people he placed in the hands of Abishai, his brother, which again he could do because grace, he was what?
One of the mighty
men. He's one of the mighty men and one of the chief leaders. Okay. He arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. So we have on one side the Arameans, on the other side the Ammonites. And he said, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. It's as close to prayer as we hear Joab giving. 13, because he's not a man of words. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they, the Arameans, fled before him. When the sons of Ammon, now who was the initial warring people? Ammon. When the sons of Ammon saw that the Arameans fled, they also fled. They knew they couldn't. They've already lost to these guys before. They also fled before Abishai and entered the city. Do you know what city he's talking about? Well, let's keep going and see if you remember. Because just as the river is one river, the city is another city. It's not Jerusalem. Joab, returned from fighting against the son of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. So the war's over. They come home. When the Arameans saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. Now we're seeing a regrouping of who?
Arameans.
The hired guys. But he doesn't like losing, this dude. What is it? However you say it. Had Ezer. He had it, Ezer. He brought the Arameans out who were beyond the river, and they came to Halim and Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, led them. Now, when it was told, David, he gathered. Now, who is now fighting?
David.
He gathered all Israel together, crossed the Jordan, and came to Helam, and the Arameans arrayed themselves to meet David and fought against him. But the Arameans fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers of the Arameans, and 40,000 horsemen, and struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. Yeah.
All right. I got a question on that. Because if you go
to
1 Corinthians 19, it says 7,000 charioteers.
Oh, it has. It goes all the way through. If you go through here, there's multiple battles.
Chronicles.
I'm sorry. Okay. 1 Chronicles 19, it says 7,000.
That's another battle.
But here, it says 700.
Well, I'll look
at that. Is that a typo?
No, it's not a typo. And I haven't studied it well enough to know, but what I did go through and started doing it from chapter 8 on, there are places where it says 22,000 went down, another place it said 18,000. Those are just different battles. Whether that is a different battle, I don't know. I do know what they did. What did they do with the horse of the Arameans?
Hamstrung them.
What does that mean?
They cut the back of the horse's lane.
So they can't,
they can no longer run and take
the chariot. And it had to do with the chariot. So I'll check into that.
I noticed that too.
You noticed it too?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because I was going back and forth and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. This
There's
says 700.
A couple thousand off
says,
here.
Yeah.
In Robert's study Bible, which I didn't bring this week, but I read last week, it said a scribe actually miswrote that.
So did he put too many in or not enough?
He only put 700. He didn't put 7,000.
It was 7,000.
He read it.
So it is a typo.
Yeah.
It's not a typo, it's kind of a translation.
Yes, it is. Well, actually, it is more accurate. It's supposed to be from God's position and picture. And it was after the war, and so they get all the information rather than just one or a scribe or something like that.
So it is supposed to be 7,000.
Yeah.
All right.
But we don't care because it makes no difference to us.
No, I know, but it was just something that caught my eye.
It's good that you did. Because, like I said, it's funny, too, because when it says, like, David only killed 700 and these other guys are killing thousands, that's what I more wondered. I didn't even catch the other thing. Okay, so the commander is dead. The charioteers are down. The horses are down to 1,000. He cuts it down to 1,000. But not from here, back from chapter 8. When all the king's servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So what is the outcome of war in that area?
David was victor.
He was victor, and what came out of it?
They served him.
And serve also brings with it, they brought tributes. Mm-hmm. And we can see they're still people. They're still a people because they've already been brought down once in chapter 8. Now they're brought down again. So they're still there. We're going to see them in the future. Eventually, we're going to not see some of these people, but not right now. So the Arameans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. Yeah, they paid a pretty good price for it, didn't they? And you found one thing to add from 19. Was there anything else you wanted to add from Chronicles 19?
You said the place. Would that have been Jericho where they crossed over?
The city?
Not yet.
Okay.
They did. You know who was in Jericho? He sent. Who did he send to Jericho?
Those were the messengers.
Oh, the messengers were in Jericho. That's right. Stay in Jericho until your beard's grown, then return. Yeah, but that's not the city. And yeah, I thought the same thing when I was looking too, when I was trying to find who that what the city was. Okay. And verse 6, when the Ammon saw that they had made... Oh, wait, no. I already went backwards. Let's go forwards. Across the Jordan came upon them.
So that's the end of chapter 10?
That was the end of 10. Now we're on 11.
The Arameans fled before Israel. David killed of the Arameans. Now there it says 7,000 charioteers. Well, that's in Chronicles. Okay. So now we're to Bathsheba. Could you see why it would have been easier to for us as students, not because the Bible had it different, but for us as students, it could be easier to study 8 and then 10 and pull those two things together. So if you're trying to understand either one of those, you have to keep them together or you're not going to get the whole picture. But in the middle of that, and I think it's really good for us to get a picture of the personal David, because we're getting a picture of the people who are warring, but we're not necessarily getting a picture of the Israelites as human beings. With a picture of Mephibosheth, we do. We get very much that picture of David as a person, not just a king. We certainly got pictures of him all the way through, but this is as he's a king. And we begin to understand what a king does, what the power he has, what he doesn't have. And like I said, my picture of the king is, you know, he sits on the throne and tells everybody else what to do, but that's not what we see here. And as Charlene pointed out, at the end of chapter 8, we have the picture of how it was all organized. It also started within that verse, how, number one, God was in charge and he's the one who led the whole thing, and how David sought justice and righteousness for his people. Let's not forget that, because that is fits moving into Mephibosheth, but it doesn't fit real well moving into the story of Bathsheba. The reason it's also important is sometimes, do you ever get a feeling sometimes that you couldn't sin when you were doing really well and had been growing for a long time?
That's about the time something
That's
happens.
Just about the time you're going to fall flat on your face and sin big. So never ever come to a point of thinking you're there now. I know there are parts of Christianity that think you can't sin once you're a Christian. Certainly isn't my experience, nor have I ever met anybody that fit. Jesus never did sin, so I can't really say anything about him. He never sinned, ever.
The only one.
The only one, and that's the point, isn't it? And that's why we follow him. Okay, chapter 11. It happened in spring at the time when kings flew out to battle. Okay, what we're going to do here in chapter 11 is we're going to give the downward spiral. And what, by the way, what did you tie on? You know me, I'm babbling. What did you title chapter 10?
U.S. battle strategy is way high for it.
That sounds good. Anything else?
Battle against the Ammonites.
Grace, how do you spell strategy?
S-T-R-A-D. S-T-R-A-D-E-G-Y.
No, it should be T-E-G-Y. Strategy?
Yeah.
Sorry.
T.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'll put both.
Sorry, Grace.
Okay. You get to decide. Okay, his strategy what? Battle strategy and battles, and somebody else said something over here.
Battle against the Ammonites.
And you could even say the Ammonites and Arameans or However it's going to help you remember, and you may just put 8 and 10 together. Continuation of 8 with the battle of the Ammonites, or finishing the battle of the Ammonites and the Arameans with Israel, however you want to do it. So 11 we come to. How did you title the 11?
David's sin with Bathsheba.
Okay.
Now I said David's sin and its consequences. Because it cost Uriah his life.
Yes, it did. And then David has his consequences in 12, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take, I'm not sure how to do this to engage you. Let me ask you this. What is the first thing David did that was wrong?
Didn't go to war. He went out of battle, he stayed home.
Okay, so the downward spiral starts in the spring.
And it's evening. He's arising from his bed. So he's been in bed.
Lazing around, huh?
Yeah, and then just decides to get up in the evening.
He's restless.
Yeah.
I think so, too. I got the feeling he was bored.
Do a walk around the roof.
Walk around on the roof.
Yeah.
Maybe it was hot.
But he's in bed, and it's not even nighttime.
You know, I think she knew that
lounging around
about it so that she felt safe. I would not have passed on the roof. Maybe that's all the way they could.
Maybe she didn't know.
But it doesn't say she was on the roof of her house. It says he was on the roof.
But we learned not to be hasty about making assumptions regarding another person's
identity. Yeah, it doesn't say she was on the roof. We just assumed she was on her roof,
right,
too.
It doesn't say that.
No, it says he was on the roof.
I don't think they don't even have windows the way we have windows, so...
Right.
And I think if I were her and I was pretty sure all the men were at war, it wouldn't be as...
Right.
Of course, I'm still not going to undress by the window, but...
That's why I can't figure out these new houses. We put the bathtub right in front of the window.
Yeah. Well, we have a very...
And then they build a house not 5 feet from the other one so they can look in the window and see what you're doing.
It wouldn't have been so bad if he saw that and turned around
right.
and immediately
okay,
left.
So,
but he let lust
all right, that's the next one then.
Heart.
Think about that. What did he do?
Look. David seen Bathsheba bathing.
He walked on the roof.
Is that just David as a killer of those giants, right?
Leonard Cohen was a Jewish man.
That's
didn't
the same
practice
guy.
Judaism,
it's the same guy.
So he knew the story.
He stayed home. He never fought.
This is what they wrote.
He mixes,
war.
He
because
mixes
the woman?
The story of
no, not
Samson
because of the woman.
For some, we don't know why.
It doesn't really tell us why he stayed home, does
no,
it?
No, it doesn't tell us why he stayed home. And we can... That's the kind of thing we can contemplate as the possibility. I do think, by the way, he was, like you said, noticed he was staying in bed till late in the morning, and maybe he just got a little tired of fighting, and he decided to stay home on this one. And he does have Joab, who is a good commander. We don't know why. It had anything to do with Bathsheba because he when he saw her, you get the feeling it's the first time he's seen her.
Well, this says it's in the evening.
Right.
So he might have went to bed and couldn't sleep, so he got up and started walking around.
Except for I don't think she's taken a bath
in the middle,
all day.
In the middle of the night. I think, well, anyway. Okay, but what was wrong? Somebody started saying it earlier.
The viewing was not the point. It was what his mind did afterwards. Right.
So he watched.
Yeah.
He watched. Mm-hmm. So he let it sit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he went over it. He watched. I'm just going to say he watched. When, exactly as you said, he could have turned his head. There isn't time. It doesn't... I remember... This is a good example. I haven't thought about that. I was... at the beach down in Laguna, we were on the evangelism team. And I just decided to walk because my legs were getting really tired. And I walked around a regular beach I walked around this corner where there was rocks, and there was this whole group of naked people. I was like, whoops, got out there as fast as I could. I thought, number one, they should have had a sign or something if it was legal. But that wasn't a choice I made. I didn't make the choice to see these people.
And I don't think David made a choice to walk out there and hoping to see a
But
person.
He didn't stop looking.
That's right.
That and when he didn't stop looking, that gave it time to think, what's the difference about that when you only have a limited income and your husband has asked you not to spend any more money this month and you walk into a store and see this, whatever you like, fill in the blank, and you just kept walking in the store and kind of coming back to it. I don't care if it's Value Village or Nordstrom's, it's still what you knew you weren't supposed to do. And you do this, it's the same kind of thing. We do the same thing. It isn't immoral like that, but it you know, again, for somebody else, it may not be sin, but for you, it is sin, and it becomes sin because you made a choice and you keep going over it. It's one of the things I've had to learn. If you don't want to end up buying it, don't keep looking at it.
Yeah. It works to take the husband along, though, and just sort of, you know.
We don't really need this in the internet.
We can put this off, and then I can get this.
Yeah, we don't have to eat for a week. We can fast for the Lord.
Someone said you can't stop the birds from flying over your head, but you can stop them from building a nest.
I've just been banned from feeding the birds, the crows in my yard, because our car has gotten massively attacked.
Oh, boy.
Don't bring it on the crows.
The black car?
Pardon?
Don't blame it on the crows. Blame it on the seagulls that fly around here.
Well, I have those, too. Yes.
I know. I'm surprised that we have the seagulls. Seagulls? Like regularly.
It was so funny. I looked out on the annex roof the other day, and they were in a line all the way along the whole roof. But they're coming to get us.
Okay. No, they're waiting for you to feed them.
They don't eat what I've put out there. This is I just put old dog. I go buy old dog food that is cheap. And the crows like it. And I do it when it's cold. When it's so cold, you can't find any food. And I do feed everything else, the bird-wise. Why not the crows? But not anymore, I guess. So I'm trying to think of ways I can do that I wouldn't be being disobedient.
Oh!
I already asked permission. I asked permission. You know, the house is
ready to send your messengers
behind me.
Oh, you feed them in the
okay.
Lot.
Does that mean that?
If you feed them in the empty lot, they're not in your car. So I would still accomplish, and he okayed it. He okayed it this morning. Okay, so he watched. What do you do next?
He inquired.
He
inquired for her.
He's planning.
Well, first he inquires.
Oh, he inquires.
Who is she?
I have a little problem with that.
You have a problem with inquired?
Yeah, because later on we found out that Bathsheba is the granddaughter.
Yes.
Of Ahithophel,
yes.
One of his best advisors.
Mm-hmm. So he should have known.
So he had probably seen her when she was a little girl running around the courts.
Mm-hmm. Obviously he didn't know it was her.
Yeah, and
he
it
asked
could
who
be
she
she'd
was.
Grown up and he hadn't seen her. But when he inquired, they must have said, well, she's the daughter of something. She's Ahithophel's granddaughter.
Kind of went out of his head.
And he didn't care.
So not only didn't he care about one of the 30.
And this is his advisor.
There are some people who look exactly like they did when they were young, and there are others who don't look anything like it. I know if I had seen, which I did, Krista when she was 3 days old, or certainly a year, she looks exactly the same.
Yes, she does.
Minus her eyebrows got thicker. And her hair got thicker. Jay, my oldest, you look at those baby pictures, I mean like a day old, and you go, that's Jay. You look at John's picture and go, who is that? You look at Chris's picture and said, I didn't know you had a blonde. You don't have a blonde. He has black hair today. So some people look like when they're little, what they look like when they're grown up, and others do not. So I don't know whether that would have worked or not. He did say the woman was very beautiful in appearance.
Well, and we're told along with that who she is.
Right.
He's told right up front, she's the wife.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That, again.
Yeah. Who her father.
But by the time he even heard that, what had he been doing?
He already had his mind made up.
He had been watching, and by the time he inquired for a purpose.
Right.
Just to stop here for a second. Deuteronomy tells the kings, there's no kings at the time, so it's kind of humorous that it says it in Deuteronomy, but it says in Deuteronomy that kings are not to multiply horses or wives.
Mm-hmm.
Why did David eliminate the excess horses? Because he was trying to obey that command. What did he miss?
The wives.
He missed the wives. What did Solomon miss? The whole thing. Just because we're obedient in one area doesn't mean we even want to be obedient in the other area. And maybe it's not a big deal for him to trust God with the wars because he's seen God win for him all over the place. He hasn't given the women to him. And this, I think, is another, we don't see it here, but that's another problem, is he already has his mind open to more than one wife. He certainly has a good enough wife in Abigail. But with the whole confusion with Michael, and then every time you see him marrying again, he marries in clumps. I mean, he doesn't just marry one woman. He didn't marry just Abigail. He married somebody else who was like, really? Did you need someone else on that one? But
they already had the commandments.
Yeah.
And in the one commandment, it says, if you look at the woman with lust, you've already committed adultery. Wouldn't he have already known that?
Well, that was the New Testament.
It is the New Testament.
That's the New Testament that Jesus interprets.
It says not to commit adultery, and Jesus is the one who gave us even a deeper picture of it.
Okay.
It's not just the act of it, it's the fact it's in your heart.
Yeah.
If it's in our heart, it's already standing against God. Okay, so what did we see at the end of chapter 8 with him and his relationship with God?
He was seeking having a righteous kingdom.
Justice and righteous, and God had led him and was leading him every step of the way. That's where we leave him in chapter 8. We come to chapter 9, and he gives and is compassionate to Mephibosheth. We come to chapter 11, and it's not such a pretty picture. So does it take much to get any of us off?
No.
Even when we have a good relationship with God, one thing we do have, although David did too, is the prompting of the Holy Spirit. So we need to listen. But I also know, for me, like if I am not in studying the Word, and if time just goes kind of by and I haven't studied the Word, I become numb. I don't feel numb. I don't think I'm doing anything bad. I'm not watching evil things on TV because we really don't have one. And, you know, I'm not running out to find something in the store, but it becomes cloudier and cloudier and cloudier. And that's when the evil one knows how to just pluck that thing right in there, right at that time. And he wasn't aware enough of walking with God at that moment that he just got out of bed. He's kind of lazing around. He's supposed to be down at the neighborhood war with the rest of the kings. If you want to know what that looks like, go to Genesis 14. You get kings killing each other all over the place. So he opened himself up. That's why it really does start with him not being where he was supposed to be. Just like it starts with us not being where we're supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here's something that you guys can all help me with. You can pray about it. I just lose my timeline. How long between that area?
I wondered that too. How old is David during this time?
So we don't know when chapter 8...
Well, if we sit and think about it, we'll look for your time senses. What are your time senses, Grace? What I mean, what tells us time? How do we find time?
Now.
Yeah, all of that, or specific things. We can find out when a king died. Is that anywhere that it tells me what time that is? I don't know.
Well, he was 30 in Ziklag, and now Absalom has his own home. And so this Ammon, the oldest, so they have to be in their 20s.
So he has to be in his 50s.
Not necessarily, more like his 40s.
40s, late 40s,
exactly
early 50s.
Exactly what I was saying. Man studying 40 is a life cycle's change. Yeah. They, I heard that, you know. 42, 43, you know, they all the learning for 30 years, age to 40, they really come from, I can do whatever I want. Kind of attitude come out. Men do the kind.
Well, and if you haven't achieved what you were expecting to achieve, I mean, how could David achieve anymore? But we don't know what his expectations were either.
And maybe it
said he's achieved so much, he is bored because he doesn't think there's any place else to go or anything else to do. When a man has reached the highest, generally, this is not always true, but generally we don't get our identity from our jobs. Men often get their identity from their job. And what is David's job? To win the world. And he's done that. So he's saying, what do I have next?
So he felt he had nothing else to conquer.
I think that could be part of why he was there. You know, it's just the same old war. I'm going to win because God's on my side. Whoa, that right there is kind of dangerous, isn't it?
Right. So, at that time, or somewhere, the men went to war at the age of 20.
The men went to war, yes. That's in...
Somewhere
in this. Leviticus and Numbers, we find that out. Where the men went to war between 20 and 50.
Yeah, but now the men then, their life expectancy was a lot longer than what we are now.
But so, in David's case, now, he had a hard life. He died at 70.
Yeah, poor dear. Poor child.
And yet, Moses didn't start reigning until he was like 80.
Yeah, until he was 80. I don't know, Grace. You could look at some.
Well, she gave me a good hint.
What Bible do you have?
K. Arthur.
Look in the back there. It should even be there.
Well, why didn't you tell me that 2 days ago?
What did you follow? The timelines and the kings and the...
They're after Second Kings. There's a timeline.
I can look that up. Now that I read it.
But it doesn't really give David's age. It just says the year.
It tells you how long they lived and stuff. It's somewhere in there.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So continue on. What's next? So what did he do next? We have her, Eddie inquired.
He sent for her.
He sent for her, or took her.
Oh, NIV?
No, it's NASB.
You made her unclean.
Now let me ask you this. Does anybody else know that this is going on?
Yes.
How do we know?
The messengers.
So the messengers knew.
Mm-hmm. And the people he asked about who she was
knew something. Okay.
Then she had to purify herself. Was that just her by herself, or did she have people that...
She said it. She purified herself from her uncleanness. I don't really know. I don't know whether she would have to go to a priest or what that means. It doesn't sound like...
It just sounds like...
She went home until she was purified.
Yeah.
So he laid with her.
She purified herself before she went on.
Right, so she's there. I assume she's still in the castle. I don't know.
And I don't know how much time that takes to for the purification.
I have a question. Why did she come to him? Because she said no.
He's the king.
No,
I didn't say that. I don't want to.
Yeah. Well, not to mention, like you were saying, if her grandfather was one of his advisors, she doesn't know what he's asking her there for. If one of our leaders invited you over for tea, would it ever occur to you that it was for illicit relations? And this, and her husband is one of his 30, and her grandfather is his. I would feel that that was a safe thing.
Well, and we have to remember, it's a different culture. We don't understand what it means to live under a king's culture, because our examples are modern kings, like over in England now.
Which are pretty inept.
Yeah.
They have no power.
They're a figurehead now.
Right.
But in those days...
Think of
Esther and the king.
She didn't have any choice.
No. You're taken.
You would have been killed had you said no.
Yeah.
Especially a king.
Yeah.
Okay, so we see her purify herself. Then what? She conceived and did what?
She told David.
So we start sort of our second level of sin. We have our first level of sin with Bathsheba. Now comes the deception and the hiding. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to let you figure out how you want to write that. We'll just say new next level.
Next step.
Pardon?
Next step.
Yeah. Next level.
Plan A. You start plan A.
Okay, so what does he do here?
He sends for the husband.
Because what?
To Joab.
He goes to Joab. So does Joab now know something?
He knows something.
It could be that he just wanted to talk to, at this point, that he just wanted to talk to one of his 30. It says, send me Uriah the Hittite. Again, observe, not he who is from Judah, but the Hittite. So Joab sent Uriah to David. And what?
David asked legitimate questions, like concerning the welfare of Joab and the state of the war, and it's like he was coming there as an official representative and messenger and telling him about the war. At this point, Uriah hasn't got any clue as to that David's trying to get him to cover up his sin.
So, was he being real? Did he really care about Joab and Uriah?
No.
He's deceptive.
Yes. I have a question. Was not Joab his commander of the army?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So did he call Joab back from battle?
Yeah. Well, Joab, we already know, was back from battle. Remember at the end of, he came home first before David went out, that time when they were pulling together the Arameans? Joab wasn't there then. He had gone home back to Jerusalem, and then David went out. So I'm assuming he was...
Well, in verse 6, it says, David sent to Joab, saying, send me Uriah. So I was thinking Joab's out there with the battle with Uriah, and he sent a messenger to Joab.
Yeah. However he did it, he Joab contacted
Uriah. Because otherwise, why would he have to send Uriah with his own death?
And actually, it was in the battle, because when he goes back, he is in the middle of a battle. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare, and we decided that that was a deceptive question. He isn't even caring. Because if he cared, he wouldn't have done the rest of what he does. So what in chapter, or verse 8, what was the next thing?
Well, it sends him to his wife to kind of try to...
have a reason that she was pregnant?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Baby came a little early?
Well, yeah, it's going to come a lot early if David's plan had followed through.
So who is the king in this now, then?
David.
So the king was sent out after him.
David.
Okay. There's only one king here.
In this story, yeah. David.
In this story, right. Okay. And he gave him a present on top of that. Boy, that's a guilt offering if I ever saw one.
Yeah.
Kind of makes you wonder what it is, doesn't it?
A bottle of wine,
give him a cow.
Some cheese.
Yeah, right.
A romantic evening at home.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. He sent him all stuff to make a nice evening at home.
A little flowers. Bit of chocolate.
Yeah.
Flowers.
From South America. Yeah. Flowers. Yeah, there you
see,
go.
Now I can't understand why Ryan wouldn't go home to her.
Well, he has his statement, and his statement is amazingly honorable.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and he did not go to his house. And David heard this, right? So what did he do? He questioned him.
Why not?
Now, why would David not understand this?
He's not thinking right now. Yeah. He's focused. He's got this focus.
He's got a plan.
Plan A didn't work. Now we got to move to plan B.
He's
what
not
is
thinking.
One of his area of sin?
It's temptation.
Women.
I think.
Just women. Yeah.
He hasn't had adultery before. He just married them all.
Right.
This one was married. So this is the first time we've seen it with adultery. And again, remember, when you have a sin that is a besetting sin and you have not given it to the Lord, it is going to crowd in on everything. Mm-hmm. Somehow, somewhere. Okay, so he asked him why he didn't go down. You've come from a journey. And what did Uriah say? And this is an amazing. Now remember, this man is a Hittite. Mm-hmm. What did he say? Verse 11.
So the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and his servants of my lord are camping in open fields. Shall I then go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing.
What is he saying here?
He's pretty honor him.
He's honorable.
He's very honorable.
Yeah.
Can you imagine in American culture where we've got it to the point that sex is a right because we're all animals and animals just do it. It doesn't matter who you really do it with. This is such a contrast to the theme of our own world today. So it's even hard to imagine how righteous and holy this statement is. David doesn't get it. Because what does he then do?
Plan B.
Plan B.
Which is?
Getting drunk.
So what did you learn about one who gets another drunk?
Okay, what day was that?
if the person doesn't have evil intent when they got drunk,
right.
They're not going to do
it. I agree with you on that.
Even the laws of our land say,
which is why he didn't.
Drunkenness is no excuse.
Which tells us, though, however, that with David, it might have, which tells you what's there in the first place.
Yep.
So David called him, he ate and drank before him, and made him drunk.
Oh,
and in the evening he went out to lie in his bed with his lord's servants, and he did not go down to his... He still wouldn't go down to his house. Then what?
Plan C.
Which is?
He sent the letter to Joab.
As you said, he sent the very letter that would cost him his life with Uriah himself.
Now Joab surely had heads up by now.
How cold can you get? Yes.
And Uriah was still so reputable. I thought about this. Would I have not read what the letter said? He didn't.
He probably had the seal on it.
Deal
of the king
oh,
on it too.
Yeah. I still don't think he would have read it.
I don't either.
No.
Because
don't
he
either.
Was an honorable man.
Yeah.
So how many times are we tempted to read the back end of a postcard when it passes through our heads?
It depends on if I know the person or not. It depends on if it's one of my children and they're in trouble.
I would have thought Joab would have questioned this. Joab's the head of the whole army.
The next thing.
Why wouldn't he have questioned that David wants him to send one of the mighty men, that you know, one of the heads up here, down to the very front line of the battle?
How do you know Joab got that it wasn't just he was putting a man of great strength in the front? How do you know that?
Because when he gave a report later, sent a report, he asked that he be sure to tell that Uriah had died.
If David got angry, use this as your last resort. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you know he knew.
Joab knew, yes.
He understood that David wanted Uriah dead. And again, you know, and I said it last time, you go back to think about these things. if you were Joab and you knew that, what would you do? I mean, don't give me answers, because they're easy answers to give, but the reality of in life, because it could have cost him everything for him to have said something. But he knew what David was doing. Okay, so anything else you want to add to that?
Well, is there a way he could have got around that? He could have sent him up there, but sent him enough backup that he put him on the front line, but he didn't get killed.
Who was he on the front line with? Verse 16.
Other mighty men. Valiant men.
Valiant men. Now, what is that?
They were valiant men there.
They were brave men fighting against the wall that people were shooting at them.
So the valiant men have been on the other team?
Arrows.
Could the valiant men have been on the other team?
Yes.
And if they were, if they were, what would he have known would happen to Uriah?
Uriah would be killed.
Because he asked the other guys to be pulled back, didn't he?
Yes. Oh.
So you're saying that they might have been part of the plunder that just came in of people?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Could be. Because where do you put your strongest... Men, if you're in the ends of a battle, you put them out in front. Mm-hmm. And he put him out in front and then brought everybody back.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says, you know, like football, you can't talk us. It says that here that he put him at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were.
So,
so the other team would be the defenders. You're the offense,
right.
You're the defense.
Right. Those are the valiant men.
But I read it that not only Uriah died, but other valiant men died. So mm-hmm. David didn't just kill Uriah.
No,
he killed his own.
It would almost have to be, because who is this is what you think about. Who is Uriah? He's a man over other men. Mm-hmm. He's their commander.
Mm-hmm. So he wasn't there just by himself.
He killed other men too.
Oh my, this is a bad place.
It gets worse and worse, doesn't it? And Joab sent and reported to David the events of the war, and he charged, as you said earlier, Kim, he charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling the events of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath arises, and he says to you, why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of... Did not a woman throw an upper millstone in front of him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you say, you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now, how do we know that they went this whole route? David got angry. How do you know he got angry? It doesn't say he got angry, but how do you know he got angry?
How come the Lord put up with him?
He's not done with him yet.
Oh.
So the messenger departed and came to report to David all that Joab had sent to tell him. And the messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall, so some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. And what was he supposed to save that last card for?
David got angry.
David got angry. So David was angry. And what was his response? Verse 25.
Oh, well, the battle's killed.
Can you imagine how cold he was by this point? Do not let this, he says to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. And now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So we end chapter 8 with an amazing position he had with God, and we are now here. And rather than go through all the cross-references, we already did 23 anyway, Chronicles 11, let's go to chapter 12. What happens in chapter 12? because it's a fairly quick chapter.
The Lord sends Nathan.
Who's Nathan?
He's a prophet.
He's a prophet. How did you guys title this one?
God sends Nathan to David.
That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? I kind of like rebuke, chastisement, confession, and consequence. Mm-hmm.
Confrontation, repentance, and consequence. That's what it's in.
What did you say? Confrontation what?
Repentance and consequence.
God sends Nathan. The prophet. What does Nathan do?
Well, he tells him his story. He just doesn't come right out and say, okay, God said this, you've messed up and you're going to get it.
I think so, he kind of makes David think through things.
Not only think, but listen.
Yeah.
If you come, and we can take wisdom in this, because some of us are still, I mean, you're still parents, whether their kids are home or not, or... I mean, your kids still do stupid things and you have to talk to them about it. But what do we learn from this on how to approach that, how not to approach it? How did Nathan not approach it? You said it earlier.
He didn't come right out and start accusing him.
He didn't just go banging into him, because what would David have done? At the very lowest, he wouldn't have listened. At the very highest, he could have taken his life. But I don't think David would have done that. He just wouldn't have listened to him. Okay, so the goal, Nathan's goal is what?
To get David's attention and have him listen.
Okay,
And to see the sin.
Very good. So he, because obviously David has gotten himself in a run that has taken his eyes off of what he's really doing. So Nathan had to get his attention, have him hear, have him lay down his defenses, in a sense.
And get him to repent.
And get him to repent. But only God can do that.
Okay.
He just had to get him to the point of knowing he sinned and admitting to it. Okay. Or just getting there. So Nathan came to David and he gave him a story. What was his story? This is another thing we can learn on. One of the things we can do is learn how to ask questions in story form. And you know, you can practice that. The way you can practice that is like if you hear something on the radio, or you're listening to the news on the TV, or you hear somebody make something, you say, how could I take that information and make it so somebody could hear that? I mean, guys, that's what evangelism is. You're taking a hardened people who don't want to hear about Christians. Right now, I'm horrified every time on the radio I hear that Trump is going to do something for the Christians. I think, oh. Because what is the rest of our nation set up right now for? They hate him. Guess what that's going to do to the Christians? It's just one more step of not listening. So we need to learn how to talk to people. To listen to them, to let them hear what needs to be heard in a form that they can hear it. And that's what Nathan did. So he goes, two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich men had great flocks and herds, but the poor men had nothing except one little ewe lamb. That sets it up right there, thinking this cute little cuddly ewe lamb, which he brought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. He brought him in the house. He would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom. He was like a daughter to him. Now the traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. David's anger burned. Evidently, he has a bit of a temper against this man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. One, must make retribution for the and for the lamb fourfold, which is a little hard if you're dying, but two, and because he did this, he had no compassion. Three. So what did he just, as he turns it around, what did he just learn?
I think if we forgot our sin and judging it quickly, you know, I do that before I'm thinking about it. I'm just laughing at that because if I have sin, you know, I don't confess or God or sorry or anything, but somebody that I can instantly get angry, they're wrong, you know.
How could they do that and get away with it?
And that's what he did. He considered himself, so he just got, he had a still compassion heart. David, in a compassion heart, but right there.
But he didn't get in himself. Yeah. He was the one not.
Exactly.
He could have filled his eyes up with what he did with Mephibosheth. He's coming to dinner every night. I know I'm a good man. And not seeing what he did. Not even letting it get past that hard wall. We have hard walls. So what was his response?
And I value the way Nathan has put this, too. I mean, of course, God speaking through Nathan. But Bathsheba was a ewe lamb. Doesn't say there's this stubborn lamb that keeps going off with other men. I mean, none of that.
No.
She's just a precious
ewe lamb.
She's
not a little
slutty
lamb. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I like what Nathan says, you. And he's got an exclamation point. I get to see with his finger, you are the man.
Well, and I always remember King James Version.
Thou art the man.
Thou art the man. Yeah.
I should have titled it. That would have helped me remember what this chapter is all about. Thou art the man.
This is the Bible, but there's a story right here that, like a five all the way, nine through. That's this day, same thing we do. It's reality, you know?
Yeah.
We're doing it, you know, quickly judging, thinking ourselves. If I were concerned thinking how I was background, how was I was bad, even constantly thinking, because the honor and the respect for one thinking that way.
No,
because we're forgetting. Right. I don't know if it's forgetting or blessing. I don't know how to think of that.
Well, I just think that there are, and especially different personalities, there are different personalities that live very much for the moment. That can be sin, that can go to sin, and that can also be the ones who are most open to other new people and situations. I mean, there's good and bad in every one of our personalities. But I would say with David's personality, he's very much that kind of person. That's why it's easy to look at Bathsheba and not tie in what else he's doing. It just is easy. And so, because we're now right at the time we need to close, tell me briefly what God said to him, what is coming up now in his life.
The sword will never depart from his family.
That's pretty horrible. What has he just, in the past, said about his family that will never depart? The throne. I mean, we've got to, and you think about that, and Jesus is the one who completes all of that. How does Jesus complete this?
Well, I liked verse 13, where David, he's repenting, and Nathan says, I have sinned against the Lord. And then Nathan says, the Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die.
But it's not done.
I know it's not done. He has repercussions, but Jesus has taken away our sin. Mm-hmm. We shall not die.
But he does. And that sword finishes with Christ.
Yep.
Because he is the one who is on the throne. And if David even had a slight gravity of that at that age, which he doesn't, it would be more horrifying than he could ever handle. So let us think about the same kinds of things when we're contemplating the very things that we know that God has already convicted us of. And deal with besetting sin that are there. And there's more here, but you studied it about the child and how David responds to that. So, Lord, we just come before you as your children, again, with all this information, and I know, Father, that you are convicting us as we need to be convicted. We ask that you give us the grace to come to you with the things going on in our lives, the grace to be compassionate, to be honorable people. We just think of Uriah and an honorable man, and I'm pretty sure that was a lost Bathsheba, that man of honor. So, God, we thank you for the history and the story, and grieve as they did in the time of its happening. In the name of your Son.